Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is Thursday, February 9th, 2017. Now look, the pensions in the United States are in complete disarray, and the Federal Reserve is mainly responsible for that because of the 8, now going on 9 years of so-called emergency ultra-low interest rates. It's a real mess, but as destabilizing as it will be for millions of retirees to suffer vastly reduced payouts along the way, with millions more taxpayers being absolutely nailed for more to close some of that pension gap, the social instability resulting from the widest income and wealth gaps in all of history will be even worse. Now, that's my opinion, and it's based on the fact that we primates simply are wired to dislike unfairness. And there's nothing more unfair than making one group slave away for table scraps while a very tiny elite are showered with free wealth, primarily consisting of money printed out of thin air. Today's guest is the perfect person to connect these dots and talk to us about the inner workings of the Fed and how it came to make the decisions it's made. Danielle DiMartino Booth spent 9 years as a senior financial analyst with the Federal Reserve of Dallas and served as an advisor on monetary policy to Dallas Federal Reserve President Richard Fisher until his retirement. Fisher called on Danielle to serve at the Fed after becoming a loyal reader of her financial column in the Dallas Morning News. She began her career in New York at Credit Suisse and at Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenrette, where she worked in fixed income, public equity, and private equity markets. She's got an MBA from the University of Texas at Austin and an MS in journalism from Columbia University. Danielle is the current president of Money Strong LLC and, the reason we're talking with her today, the author of the very newly released book, Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. Danielle, welcome to the program.
Chris, I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, thank you. So where do we even start? How about with the fact that out of them all, I admired Richard Fisher the most. So he came not from academia, but from private industry. I know he ran his own business. He regularly criticized Fed policy. He even recently said that Fed monetary policy put beer goggles on investors and protected Congress from fiscal malfeasance. What was he like to work for?
Well, I will say he was like a breath of fresh air. We both started off as rookies, him obviously a bit earlier than me, on Wall Street. We both have MBAs. And we both have a deep appreciation for how the financial markets interact with economic data and with monetary policy. So it was an absolute honor for me to work with him. He has called me his eyes and ears on the market. And also he's called me his secret weapon. So he never walked into an FOMC meeting without being armed with a lot of my take on where the markets were and how they were reacting to Fed decision making.
Well, from 2006 to 2015, one of your job duties at the Dallas Federal Reserve was to, quote, advise policymakers on potential systemic risks building within the financial system. I have to ask, what sorts of potential systemic risks did you surface, and was anybody besides Richard listening?
Well, I think that there were a handful of people who were listening throughout the years. I became a great admirer, and I got to know Jeremy Stein. And as you know, he could have stayed longer on the Board of Governors, but he chose instead to return to Harvard. He was what I consider to be the best of both worlds. He had a deep academic understanding. He carried a PhD in economics, but he also had another foot squarely planted on planet Earth. And I think that that gave him a unique take, and that's why he and Fisher got along so well when they were both serving on the FOMC.
Well, so in your book then, Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America, which by the way,
it's a really subtle subtitle, isn't it?
subtle subtitle, but perfect, right in my sweet spot. And by the way, it's the best one that I've yet read. Because really great writing. You had me right from the opening scene. where you're outlining that December 2008 meeting where everybody walks in, you know, what the weather was like, just really painting the stage for us. But you note there right in the front that one, air quotes here, feature of the Fed is that almost all of the staffers there are PhD academics, that is people with really no practical real-world experience, but plenty of models and rigid, dare I say, dogmatic ideas about how things work. Why is that a problem?
Well, I think it becomes a problem because it fosters myopia. If you consider what economics in the United States, and for that matter, all around the world has become, there has been a global movement against dissent. And there's been a global movement within the entire economic profession against thinking outside of that proverbial box. And I think you run into serious issues if you've got the majority of people seated around a table about to undertake, as they did in December 2008, an extraordinarily important decision, but most of them are thinking alike. It's going to be very difficult to poke holes in arguments or to play devil's advocate when there's such a supermajority of the same type of thinking.
Not just the same type of thinking, but in this case, I think academic thinking, which, you know, Nassim Taleb wrote an extraordinarily good piece around that. And also Ben Hunt of Epsilon Letters wrote a really nice piece around the saying that to understand the culture of academia is to understand centrist thinking, meaning everybody wants to appear smart. Nobody wants to be the outlier. Everybody feels safer as long as they're as smart as the centrist smart decision that's being made. So it's really, of the cultures that exist out there, it's really one of the worst ones you could have for dissent when it comes to things that are academic or intellectual in nature. And these were some of the most important decisions ever being made. Hey, let's take interest rates to a place they haven't been ever in history. And they just sort of like trundled along. So this was really, I mean, to understand what happened, we have to understand the culture of the Fed. Is that right?
I think it absolutely is right. I mean, if people ask me, you know, why were you so compelled to write this book? Look, I have four young children and plenty of other things that I could have done with the last 2 years of my life. But when people ask me why I was compelled to write Fed Up, it is because of how ostracized I was within the institution, because I didn't have this centrist way of thinking, and because I chose to raise my hand over and over again and say, wait a minute, let's stop and think through how this is going to play out in the real world and question where we're going rather than just go headstrong into a decision that, by the way, is not just going to affect the United States and pensioners and retirees in our country, but it's going to take a global lead, and you will have other central banks around the world, as has been the case, follow your lead into uncharted territory, making the implications that much more global and systemic and connected and interconnected.
Well, very well said. So you did decide to write this book. I have to ask, I'm going to guess that maybe that not everybody at the Fed is going to be thrilled with it, or maybe some will because they share your views. How do you think your book's going to play at the Fed?
I don't think it's going to be on anybody's coffee tables this Christmas.
maybe not on purpose.
Well, look, but that's not the point. You know, as somebody commented on a Wall Street Journal story on the book, And I really did appreciate the comment because there's a vast amount of endnotes, as you'll see at the end of the book. This book is meticulously documented. Mm-hmm. But somebody commented on the original Federal Reserve Act verbiage that states and demands that there be a lot of diversity of thought on the Federal Reserve Board and among Federal Reserve District bank presidents. It's actually part of the law, and it has been completely disregarded. And because I was an outsider on the inside, would I have ever decided to go inside the Federal Reserve and work for anybody but Richard Fisher? Maybe Charlie Plosser. He was another wonderful maverick who served alongside Richard Fisher from the Philadelphia Fed. But I chose to do what I did for God, country, and man because I'm concerned about my children and their children, and all of the retirees. I have a 70-year-old mother who's been forced to make some very difficult choices, not as difficult as a pension fund manager, as you started out the podcast referring to, but all of these difficult decisions did not have to be forced upon us. And that is why, one of the major reasons I was compelled to write this book.
Well, thank you for that. And so let's go there for a second, because, you know, the context was the world's falling apart. We have to do something to save the world. And of course, the world to the Federal Reserve is the banking system and maybe a little bit of concern for the corporations that are out there that were also on the ropes. But here are the few of the sins that I've laid at the feet of the Fed. So, and I know you've noted many of these as well, and I'm sure you have others. So first, expensive housing that barely benefits the existing holders of housing, right? Because what does a more expensive house do for you except drive up your insurance payments and your property taxes potentially, while also punishing the young and other first-time buyers? We have, as you mentioned with your own mother, savers that have lost hundreds of billions in interest income that was transferred to banking income statements, a wealth gap that is the largest on record, ruined pensions that are in many cases simply never repairable under current math. The math is that bad. And continuing to foster the delusion that Congress can continue to borrow without any eventual ill effects. I mean, is it fair to lay all of that and maybe more at the feet of the decisions that really were undertaken in 2008?
Well, I would say two things. The first is you left out the cohort to come, and that would be my children. Mm-hmm. We have set up faux savings accounts here in our home so that we can try and do what Bank of America and their little savings accounts cannot do for them, which is instill the miracle of compound interest in their minds and foster a culture in our own home that saving is a good thing to do because it pays over time, which an entire generation of Americans has been robbed of. That's the first. The second thing I would say is that it's not just at the feet of the Fed. It is also what you mentioned earlier, Richard Fisher and congressional malfeasance. Congress has overly relied upon the Fed to do their heavy lifting for them. But back to your original question, would they have been able to misbehave as they have had they not had a banker? And the answer is no. It takes two to tango, and had the Federal Reserve not facilitated Congress's bad behavior, we wouldn't be in the same situation that we're in today. So yes, it's circular, but it does lay at the feet of the Fed.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, taking the other side of this, I run into this all the time. They say that, look, if the Fed had not done what they had done, things would be far worse. You know, we've got a not ruined economy today. We've got reasonable job growth. We've got a much sounder banking system. If you agree with those as sort of the outgrowths of Fed policy, were those a reasonable trade-off for the other things we've just been talking about?
Well, yes and no. I don't think that the housing bubble would have existed had Alan Greenspan not taken to heart what one of his chief advisors and closest associates, Ed Gramlich, said to him in the heat of the housing bubble, which is that, sir, we've got a problem here. There are people buying too much home. There are people that are overextending themselves, to which Alan Greenspan flippantly replied, We only technically regulate 25% of mortgage lending in this country. The rest of it does not lay on us, which of course is not true. The Fed was called in to clean up the entire mess that they created. So you have to lay that as an essential backdrop. And then you get the justification for QE1. You don't get the justification for zero interest rates. We never had to go to the zero bound at the Fed. That was never an essential necessity. That was never a number one requirement for us to launch the liquidity facilities that had to be launched when it was DEFCON 1 and you were talking about a global depression. I think that absolutely had to be addressed. Now, after we prevented the world from melting down, a situation that was created, again, by the Fed, were the other things that were done to placate Wall Street necessary? Were we staring down the barrel of the abyss at that point? No. It was the actions that were taken subsequent to QE1 that really laid the groundwork for where we are today and perpetuated the cycle of boom, bust, where we found ourselves since Alan Greenspan first launched what's called the Greenspan put on October the 20th, 1987. This is a problem of our own making.
And a long time in the making as well, since it started in 87, and also it happened with the corporate bond hiccup in 94, which gave us the easy money that led to the 2000, which gave us, here we are. So it's been a serial bubble blowing sort of an organization, each one larger than the rest. Today, if we can take sort of here we are today, I'd love to get your views as somebody who's been able to spot these trends and critique them. My view is that today we have a global central banking system that is now hostage to the enormous balance sheets that they've got. They don't know how to unwind them, and they seem, maybe this is not fair, but it seems to me that they're terrified of financial markets having any sort of a down day, given how often they trot out officials to talk markets down, calm them, and also throw more money in. Is that fair? And if these are sort of Franken markets of central bank creation, how would they begin undoing what they've done?
You know, Chris, that's the trillion-dollar question. And we didn't used to call it that, did we?
No.
We used to call it the million-dollar question. But that is the trillion-dollar question. You know, there are the punditry out there will tell you that the Fed has been in tightening mode since the taper began several years ago. But I say hooey to that. What we have today is absolute fungibility with central bank purchases on a global basis. So you're talking about something upwards of $200 billion every single month. And I think that what the global bond market now revolves around and relies upon is the assumption that somebody somewhere is going to be conducting quantitative easing.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they do that, and I'm going to dig a little bit into the weeds here and you consider supply-demand, as long as they do that, then we're operating in a bond market that is assuming that every single bond purchased by a central bank globally has been expired permanently. So you're taking supply out of the system, which is the only thing that could get you to justify where bond yields are, and therefore the mirror image of that, where bond prices are, which is, of course, at record highs or close to record highs. And that, I think, is at the crux of central bankers' global dilemma. It's that the first central bank that even hints that they're going to start to reduce the size of their balance sheet, or even worse, sell off a single bond, and I think it's game over at that point for the world bond market.
Well, and it has been a big, they're all holding hands and singing kumbaya because, you know, they say, oh, well, the Fed's now tightening. But if you add up the major central banks, Bank of Japan, United States, England, ECB, put them all on one balance sheet sort of chart, you can't see any deflection in the line. And it started about 2006, and they've just been adding as they go along. And I'll include China in that as well. So it has been a worldwide, we're just going to keep growing central bank balance sheets, trillion-dollar question. Can they just keep doing that?
Well, look, I think that we have seen that there are mechanistic challenges that have presented themselves along the way. You've got corporate bonds in Europe trading at record high prices mm-hmm. because the ECB has been out there buying corporate bonds, which is someplace, thank heavens, the U.S. Federal Reserve never had to go. You have the Japanese central bank. You have the Bank of Japan hitting its outward limits in terms of owning every ETF out there. And one of the reasons that's less appreciated out there and that presented its own obstacle to the Federal Reserve is at some point we were buying up 80% of the mortgage-backed securities net issuance out there. We were running into technical difficulties in keeping the mouse on, running on that wheel. So are there limits? I think there are practical limitations to QE. And the market distortions that are introduced, the further we go out on that spectrum in terms of assets that are being purchased, corporate bonds, equities, the more difficult it becomes to keep QE going. But by the same token, the more difficult it becomes to extricate ourselves from the process.
Well, I'll tell you the next logical direction that I think, well, illogical, depending on your point of view, where this goes. And here I want to focus down a little bit, is to get into this idea of pensions. So turning to pensions here, I happen to be in Dallas at this moment where the police pensions in complete disarray, and certainly a few bad, if not maybe criminal, bets were made on real estate, and that was a contributing factor to the Dallas police pension difficulties. But the zero-bound rates forced on all of us by the Fed are a really big factor in the actuarial distress of the Dallas pension, as it is for every pension in the land. So looking at this, is it as bad as I'm making it out to be? Because I think it's a complete disaster, as many do. But secondarily, is this another area that the Federal Reserve might step in and say, oh, well, let's just make this whole as well?
Well, first of all, that's illegal. But what I would say, since we both happen to be in Dallas right now, I live in Dallas, but what I would say is that the Dallas pension situation is an extreme example, but it also gives us a very clear prism into some of the more difficult decisions that have been undertaken by pension fund managers given their actuarial realities. And that is, when you're bumping up against the zero bound and zero interest rates, and your states and municipalities do not have the funding to realistically lower your rate of return assumptions to where they need to be. Bear in mind, the UK, the United Kingdom, has a rate of return assumption legally capped at 3.5%, so that pension fund managers are never forced to go out and buy things like real estate that are highly inappropriate to put grandma's money in, by mm-hmm. the way. But so many public pensions across the United States have been making these very poor decisions and piling into not just high risk investments, but illiquid ones, which brings us back around to what's happening in Dallas. The most frightening thing about the de facto run on the Dallas pension is the headlines that it garnered and the potential precedent that it sets for when financial markets pull back and you have some kind of wholesale run on not one or two or three, but many pension funds across the country, and no legal wherewithal for anybody to bail them out. Last I checked, we've got a Republican Congress, and Republicans don't cotton to the idea of sending money to states and municipalities and bailing out their pensions, which gets us to the very first point you brought up, which is social strife.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's no legal ability to bail out. The Fed has no legal charter license to bail out pensions.
Well, I think, you know, Janet's been sort of hinting that, you know, the Fed would love to be able to dabble in other assets, which I'm going to presume are equities, and also potentially bailing out pensions if it comes to that. So I was reading a piece written that was based on your Real Vision interview with Grant Williams, a great guy. I admire him a lot. And in there, you noted that the $1.3 trillion, with a T, trillion pension deficit just takes into account state and municipal obligations, and with promised returns of 8% or 7%, but they've been they're compounding at a much lower rate than that. And so you noted in there that it's going to take nothing short of an economic miracle to recover. So the average state pension, quoting here, in the last fiscal year returned something south of 1%. You cannot fill that gap with a bulldozer. Impossible, you said. And you also said anybody who knows their compounding tables know you don't make that up. Please explain for people who don't know their compounding tables what you meant by that.
The problem with pensions, and what I was getting to, is that the sins are compounding over time. They're piling up. Every single fiscal year that goes into the history books with a 6% plus gap in terms of what's assumed and what's returned piles on to the next year of equal, if not worse, relative underperformance. So you're talking about the equity and the bond markets and the majority of investments in pensions having to make up for all that lost time, but in spades, at multiples of what the current rate of return assumptions are going forward on an ongoing basis for years to come, which is highly unrealistic when you're staring down the barrel of an almost 40-year bull market in bonds and the second longest bull market in U.S. history outside of that which culminated with the internet NASDAQ implosion. The assumptions are simply, they're Herculean in magnitude and impossible to achieve. And that's why you're seeing, of course, starting with CalPERS, they always start the trend. That's why you're seeing rate of return assumptions begin to come down, which is all good, fine, and well until you completely square the circle and understand that every time a municipality or a state pension plan reduces their rate of return assumption, some entity, whether it be the state, the school district, some entity has to write a bigger check in order to make up for the cash flow that's no longer being assumed in by the actuaries via rate of return investments. It doesn't work. You can't do it for very long when you're not bringing money in as a state or municipality. I'll throw one example out there, which is my favorite. The city of Denver. Mm-hmm. This is well over a year ago. This is a Wall Street Journal story. It was kind of quaint. They were pulling their tulip budget for the city, and they were going to make up for that with less expensive foliage of some kind with which to make the city look pretty. What happens when it's police and fire department and sanitation and ambulance funding that's being cut? What happens to the social fabric of these communities when you're starting to cut to the bone because you have to reduce your rate of return assumptions and put more tax revenues into the pensions to top them off?
I giggled a little there because the idea of that that the Fed's blown these cereal bubbles and they've gotten us into this big trouble, and that ultimately Denver has to cut the tulip bulb budget. It circles back around to the early 1600s in Holland there. So fantastic example, but it's to go back to CalPERS, they just went from 7.5% to a 7% assumed rate of return. Their last 2 years averaged out, I think, at just around 1% return. So 7 is even maybe highly optimistic given their most recent returns. But even just that move from 7.5% to 7%, that 0.5% wiggle, is creating enormous budgetary difficulties for lots of smaller municipalities. Point one. Point two is that the combined deficit of CalPERS now is around $95,000 per household in California. Let's assume each household has an average of $10,000 in property taxes. Maybe that's low, I don't know, but it makes the numbers easy in my head. That means that paying for nothing else for the next 9.5 years, assuming the hole doesn't get any bigger, all property taxes in California would have to just get funneled into CalPERS just to fill that hole. So point three is the hole isn't going to get filled. How does this play out, Danielle?
Well, it doesn't play out very well. If you really want Shakespearean tragedy, look up the State of the State address that Governor Brown recently presented to his legislature. It's as if a lot of these people maybe they were central bankers in their last life. That's my gallows humor for the day. But this doesn't work. Look, where we're sitting today in Dallas, Texas, we are sitting in the middle of relocation central. Consider that Toyota Corporation was in Torrance, California for decades. It's where it first established itself here in the United States. By the way, it's relocated to Texas. Over 9,000 companies over the past decade have abandoned California, and they've relocated mostly to a no-income tax state called Texas, where it's a lot easier to do business. Now, extrapolate how many companies have left California to how many individuals have left California. Drive around Austin, Texas today. Mm-hmm. You'll see a lot of California license plates. What California is going to be facing in the years to come, and I would venture to say other states like New York and Illinois, is a barbell population. They're going to have the wealthy who can afford to pay, you name it, in state income taxes, because all they want is their view and the ability to, by the way, express their view. And you'll have the people who are caught up in the social safety net and covered by the expansive state benefits. But as far as the middle class, the squeeze that you described in the property taxes and the amount of money that they simply don't have because they might want to send their kids to college one day, they'll leave, and they will continue to leave. And so you will see a tax base that is of the lowest income and the highest income stratas and nothing in between. And again, this is going to roll around to gee, Uncle Sam, we've got a problem. And whether or not Congress decides to step in and help out the state. And those are very, very tricky issues depending upon who's running Congress and who's in the White House.
Well, it gets trickier too because it's sort of like a housing crisis part two, which is that those who were prudent really get punished and the people who are imprudent seem to get bailed out. So, you know, Illinois, failed to tax itself properly or make good decisions and maybe they get a bailout. But what about the state that ran itself more prudently? They get nothing. And so it's really, it just keeps digging this unfairness hole. And so when I add all of this up, you know, look, great that the Federal Reserve has driven the stock market to all-time highs and that they've, you know, created a lot of, you know, that a year and a half ago, it was 62 people had as much wealth as 3.5 billion people in the world. Today, that's 8 people, right? That's an example of this compounding effect of just throwing money into the markets to try and get the tail to wag the dog. Hasn't happened. I want to turn now. I also have 3 children. They've really peered into their aged 22 to 16, but they've peered into this future and said, I can't connect with this story. It doesn't make sense. We have this crumbling infrastructure. We haven't really invested in ourselves. Corporations don't have this sort of loyalty to the employees we used to have anymore. It just, there's all this debt. I'm going to pay into a social security system that I'm pretty sure won't be there for me. The whole idea of the American dream, including household formation and all of that, really seems to have just been snatched away from an entire generation. And that's something that I think the Fed needs to be attached to because it really was the consequence of their sets of decisions in many ways. And so, again, I know you've hinted at this, but what really is what are our children really facing here, do you think?
Well, I think our children are facing a crisis of confidence. I hate to say anything so cliche as we've lost an entire generation in the millennials. Unfortunately, a lot of millennials were raised against a backdrop of their parents taking on too much debt, and now you have the sense of entitlement. But talk about your children's generation. Their first memory is of 9/11. So they feel that they have been under attack kind of from day one. And from everything I hear from your children's generation, the generation behind the millennials, is that they have a superb work ethic and that they desperately want to save and get ahead and that they've recognized that something is bereft and that something has been stolen from underneath them and that they want to make things right and make America great again. Gosh, I can't believe I just used those words.
Mm-hmm.
But that there is a determined generation behind the millennials to right the wrongs. They might need a central bank that wants to go alongside with them and stop destroying the American dream, which is what's happened when you take away the virtues of saving today to invest tomorrow in a world where you can't do that. I mean, if you look at the education system in this country that's been absolutely hollowed out, it's easy enough to leave education reform behind if you're Uncle Sam, if you've been borrowing at 1.8% for years on end. Thank you, Fed. You leave the hardest decisions under the carpet. You never undertake them. And who loses? All of the youngest generations.
Well, indeed they do. And when I think about what do they really have to look forward to in this story, it's going to require really thinking differently. We're going to have to be bold. And your first chapter in your book, Fed Up, is group stink. What is it going to take for us to break the group stink here? Not just at the Fed, but maybe more broadly. To broaden this conversation up slightly, we have different groups of people now who are really talking past each other, seem to have lost the art of understanding the other side's point of view. We're going to have to sort of figure out how to close that gap. But the first thing we have to get rid of is the old thinking that just didn't work. In my mind, the Fed achieved a few things that seemed to go its way, but on balance, everything you and I have been talking about, all the things that are so beautifully characterized in your book, Fed Up, is that on balance, even more things went wrong. Because hey, real world, right? You got your theories, but here's the real world. I don't see the Fed adjusting their stance, their reactions, their policies based on the data that is actually pouring back in, which includes things like household formation, the educational gap, the loss of the American dream, the wealth gap, all that stuff, right? So how do we, you know, you've got a chapter in there about heads must roll. How do we get back to this? Is there some way to, that does it begin with accountability? Does it begin with, where do we go from here? How do we get started on closing this gap now?
Well, with any luck, we get started by filling the two vacancies on the Federal Reserve Board with people who actually know that the word no is not a four-letter word. You have to start with dissent. And that has to be introduced where it's been completely absent, almost completely absent. We've had two dissents on the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C. at the Fed since 1996.
Two
dissents. The rest of the dissents have come from district bank presidents. So you have to start with dissent inside the inner sanctum, on the Board of Governors. And there is an immediate opportunity to introduce dissent with those two open vacancies. And then I would argue that you've got four more positions that can be filled along the way in the first 2 years of the current administration. And that's where it begins. It begins with a different way of thinking and a revolution on the board.
Well, the last time I added it up, we on the FOMC board of the voting members, we had 100% either academics or people with law degrees who came up through all the right places in D.C. But lawyers have a way of thinking, and it's a style. But when you talked originally about the diversity of opinion and also geographical diversity and maybe industry diversity that's in the law, in the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, that talks about the diversity that we would want to see on there, which makes sense that when you only have academics and lawyers who all of whom have come up through the power structure of DC or through some academic structure, that's probably the least diverse sort of viewpoint assemblage I could imagine.
Of course it is. Look, look, there are a handful. In fact, I personally own municipal bonds. There are a handful of states and municipalities who have well-run, disciplined pensions in spite of everything. So go find your rock star pension fund manager who's been on the receiving end of Fed policy and has pushed back against it and successfully done so. Put that person on the board. Go find a CFO who has managed to run a tight ship and not simply take out more debt and buy back shares over the years, who has been vastly tempted. There's the money. It's free. Borrow it. Buy your shares back. Increase your personal bonus on an annual basis, and then leave the company fat and happy. Go find that CFO. Put them on the board. Put people who have been on the receiving end of Fed policy and who understand it on a practical level. Introduce them. They will dissent. They will stop the They'll stop the innerness, the group stink, as I call it. They'll get rid of it.
Well, that would be a breath of fresh air, and I would really support that. Hey, everybody, we've been talking with Danielle DiMartino Booth. Her new book is Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. I think you should read it because, look, we all deserve to know what happened and why, but also because we simply must band together and place accountability where it belongs and seek to prevent any more well-meaning but irreversible damage by the eggheads at the Fed. Hey, I say that as a former egghead myself, and Danielle's just given us a very, very good suggestion for how to go about doing that. Hey, let's put people who have different points of view on there so we can actually have a debate form when really aggressive, once in a lifetime, maybe once in all of history, decisions are being undertaken. Thank you, Danielle. Please, could you tell people first how they can follow your excellent work more closely and also then where they can buy your book?
Absolutely. So if you go to, first of all, follow me on Twitter at DiMartino Booth. I never put anything raunchy and impolite. It's always well thought out inside 140 characters. My website is, my Money Strong website is www.dimartinobooth.com. Please read my newsletter every week. I never fail to entertain and educate. And go to Amazon.com, go to Barnes & Noble, go to Indie Books, go wherever you want, but buy the book. Not only is it informative, I've actually been told, I say this humbly, it's an entertaining read. So enjoy it and give it to your children and give it to your parents.
And maybe leave it on a Fed staffer's coffee table accidentally. Just park it there.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Well, Danielle, all the best with your book, and thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Appreciate you taking the time for me.